Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of the BFG podcast. This week I am here with a useless tourist.
That's not funny at all. I'm the one that dressed up, and he's making fun of me.
Yeah, I didn't put in any effort.
It's the day before Halloween, and he's making fun of me for being dressed up.
I put in zero effort, and...
He's dressed up as a washed up...
Comedian.
Boom.
Which got him. Looks the same as a regular comedian most of the time, I guess.
Dang, you didn't have to take out all comedians, dude. Chill. What do the comedians do to you?
They stopped being funny.
Wow. All
right. But anyway, today we are back with this episode is about Last Night in Soho, which has been one of my most anticipated movies of the year because it's Edgar Wright's new movie.
Mine too.
That's it this week.
Yeah. I don't know if you guys know, because like we've talked about it before, but like, you know, might have flown under the radar. Edgar Wright is his favorite director.
Yes.
He is all about Edgar Wright.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you know, this is a big deal for him.
This is like one of his biggest departures from his kind of like genre hopping too, whether it be kind of like horror comedy or action comedy or sci-fi comedy, you know, or even Baby Driver kind of hopped between genres a little bit. This is his most like clear cut, like he wanted to make a thriller,
a horror thriller,
and he wanted it to be in the style of like the 60s and 70s giallo horror films, kind of that surreal, very saturated, color-coded style of like Dario Argento and stuff like that.
Which to an extent I think he did.
Yeah, but we'll talk about that more in a little bit.
Yeah, we got a thing to do.
To start off this week, instead of doing like necessarily a game, I got some more kind of like conversational topics to ask you. So I looked at a couple different articles, and there are some questions I skipped because it's like that either really generic, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it's either that stuff like, you know, hey, what?
Guys that clearly aren't film buffs like the two of us. All right, come on. Okay.
Well, it's one of those where there were questions like, who do you think is the most beautiful actress? And it's like...
Well, that's a very objective thing.
Yeah, like, everything is. You know, it's like us reviewing movies, we have objective thoughts about movies.
Stop poking holes in what I say, Tyler.
But it's like... I feel like there's better things to talk about than how beautiful they are, you know?
Yeah.
It's like...
Who's most talented?
Yeah.
Like, while your baby is being adorable right now, this is going to be a nightmare audio-wise.
With all that said, I've got some questions that I felt like were actually worth talking about and going over.
Yeah.
So there's 12 of them. The first of which is, what's your favorite genre of film?
That's really hard. Because I've been kind of bouncing around genres like my entire life. Whereas at the beginning, when I was like a younger kid, I was all about like medieval fantasy and stuff like that.
Okay.
Mainly because of the Lord of the Rings films and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then growing up, I became more of like a thriller drama kind of guy.
Mm-hmm.
With like Prisoners and those kinds of like deep like thriller drama genre films.
Yeah.
I was like, you know, I wasn't a big horror fan at all as a kid. Mm-hmm. I was terrified by it.
Mm-hmm.
My older siblings would watch like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake.
Yeah.
In the living room, and I'd be terrified, and they'd like hide the phone, like the house phone, so I couldn't go and call my dad and be like, "Dad, they're watching scary movies,"
mm-hmm.
and complain, because like I was just terrified of them, dude. I've like always been like really susceptible to like women, children, and animals like being hurt or injured in movies.
Yeah.
That always like it's always bothered me. Mm-hmm. I cried in Ace Ventura: Pet Detective 2 when the raccoon fell and I thought he died, even though he didn't. But I still cry, you know. So it's like it's always been a thing for me.
It just shows that you're sensitive.
Yeah, but even though that's not a horror movie, well, I could argue that it is. But like you know, but recently I've become like a huge fan of like those avant-garde horror films like Midsommar, Hereditary, or Black Swan.
Yeah,
where like. They're clearly genre pieces, and they... Oh my god, look at my hair when I mess with it. They're clearly genre pieces, and they have those, like, those genre elements, like, really heavily in there.
Yeah.
And they're definitely like, you know, what you would expect a horror movie to be, but they're made so differently than like this, what the zeitgeist, you know, says they should be.
Yeah.
Whereas like you get something like Wish Upon, which is like, you know, all around stupid. Like I've become like just wholly fascinated in them. Yeah. So right now I think my favorite genre is horror. That's just like, you know, the one that I've been like completely invested in over the past few months and like really diving into.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of where I was going to go with it too. My favorite genre has been horror for a long time. And it's like, I've got this weird, like, encyclopedic knowledge almost of, like, all these different horror films, whether they're good or bad. Mm-hmm. And, like, there's so many bad, which I think is almost part of the fun, because there's so much crap to sift through. Mm-hmm. It's like you find those hidden gems, and it's like, oh, this is great. You know, it's like finding a diamond in the rough almost, because I don't know if there's any other genre that's just so full of garbage.
It's saturated with it.
Yeah.
Like, full on.
Yeah.
And like, looking through his letterbox and seeing, like, the amount of, like, bad horror movies he's seen is really impressive, honestly. The fact that you're able to sit through all these. And we'll be, like, standing around talking at work, and he'll be like, have you seen this, like, obscure, like, bad horror movie that no one's really seen? And I was like, no. He's like, oh, dude, it's awful.
Yeah.
All right.
And so that's, and it's been like that since, I don't know, since I was maybe like 12, 13.
Yeah.
I remember there was an episode, are you familiar with the 90s Nick show? I think it was Nickelodeon. It was called,
Are You Afraid of the Dark?
No, Ghost Rider.
No, actually, no. Have you seen that?
So it was like this spirit that would help kids like solve mysteries and stuff.
That's so funny.
But they had a Halloween themed episode where there was a little, like, this gross purple doll named Gooey Gus. And like, the doll was kind of creepy, but that wasn't what scared me. What scared me was the concept behind the episode was that Gooey Gus, he would spit out gum. He was also like a Pez dispenser almost, and he would spit out gum. But the horror part would come in where once they started chewing the gum, they could never stop chewing the gum. And so they would start like blowing bubbles and stuff, and it would like encapsulate them and like suffocate them within like this giant like mess of gum, because it was just like infinite gum pouring out of their mouths. They couldn't get rid of it. And I remember just that concept of like this little purple doll like spewing like purple gum at you until you died of suffocation.
Yeah.
Just like that in my like, you know, preteen mind just scared me so bad.
Boy, if that doesn't sound like an original Dan Schneider Nickelodeon.
And that was
Dan Schneider is making a Gooey Gus where he encapsulates children in bubbles so he can kidnap them.
Adam Sandler plays Gooey Gus, the doll that kills children.
In this great new Netflix movie.
But like that was one of the first forays to like actually being like truly frightened. And I remember like I would be up at night like screaming and so scared. Yeah. And there was a time period where my mom would sit outside my room. She would leave the door open and she would sit outside the room like reading or sewing or whatever it was that she did to try to calm me down and get me to go to sleep. And that went on for like probably a month or two before I was able to like sleep on my own again.
Yeah.
But after that, that was kind of like that big jolt. After that, it was like it was fine again, you know?
Yeah.
And that was when I started
like, what a rush.
Yeah. And pretty much that's how it went. And then I just kind of started like binging all these horror movies.
Yeah.
And
had never stopped.
Yeah. And that was like the gateway into this world. Oh, wow. But yeah, so I'd probably agree. I think horror is what I've always been most drawn to. But, you know, now it's more like I see these bad horror movies that have these like dumb villains. And I'm like, oh, this is dumb. But, you know, that it's like you find those hidden gems like the Babadook.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And it's like, oh my gosh, this is what horror can be. So why do we have so much drivel, you know?
Yeah. It is like there's other kind of not as much horror movies like Black Swan or like The Nightingale, which I would consider a horror movie, made by the same person that made The Babadook.
Mm-hmm.
And like those are what really get me. Like, I am all about those.
Yeah.
Like, but if you give me, like, a stupid mainstream horror movie, I'm going to hate it because they all follow the same formula.
Yeah.
So it's, like, it's really hard to, like, try and sift through all the crap to find, like, the good hidden gems in there.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, I mean, like, and, like, your favorite movie and my favorite movie are both horror movies.
Yeah, either horror or quasi-horror some fashion.
But, you know, that's, like, yeah, that's a given. It's a great genre, even though it's probably the one that has the most crap outside of maybe comedy. Comedy is awful most of the time. Like, let's be honest. A lot of bad comedies out there.
Yeah. Next question, number two. Do you think theaters are too expensive, and how much is it really worth it for you to go to the theaters?
That's a tricky one because, like, I'm really, like, I'm so willing to spend money at a theater that, like, I don't really notice it when I do go there and I have to, like, buy this, like, $5 bottle of water.
Yeah.
Like, it's ridiculous, yeah, but, like, when I'm there, I don't think about it. And, like, the tickets, I think the ticket price is fine. Like, the ticket price doesn't bother me. It's really the concessions is, like, the only thing that I could say is, like, definitely overpriced.
Mm-hmm.
But again, like, it doesn't really bother me, and, like, I'm more than willing to help the artist in by, like, and help theaters by just, you know, buying their goods.
So what about, like, beyond the regular price of a ticket, you know, you've also got different gimmicks, like, you know, IMAX screenings or XD screenings and things like that. Uh-huh. Do you think that, like, bigger screens and better surround sound are worth more of your money than just, like, a regular screening?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
I do fully believe that. Because, like, you could watch it, like, basically for free on a streaming service on your phone.
Mm-hmm.
Where you can go to, like, a regular theater, see it on a much larger screen, which, with better resolution, better sound. Or you can go to, like, an IMAX thing with even better screen or an even better sound. Like, it's just a natural progression upward. And, like, if you can watch it for free on a shitty screen and watch it for, like, way more of the price on, like, the best screen possible, then, like, you know, it makes sense to charge more.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I'm not upset with that.
Mm-hmm. And what about, like, other gimmicks? Like, when Spy Kids did, like, Smell-O-Vision.
And 4D.
Yeah, or, like, when they were doing when they tried to revitalize the 3D stuff. Like, what was it, 10 years ago or something?
Okay, now those, I've never been a fan of those. Mm-hmm. Of, like, 3D and stuff like that. I can see why they'd want to do it, but it's not for me.
Yeah.
So, I, you know, I don't really care for it, but I can see, you know, the reasoning behind, like, having it and charging more. Mm-hmm. I think it's a stupid gimmick that they'd get, like, the people in the 20s, if you plugged in, like, a 3D movie, not even a good one, but just, like, a 3D movie in, like, the 1920s, and just, like, played it to a bunch of the people back then, their heads would explode.
Yeah.
Seeing, like, this bouncy ball just, like, go towards them.
Yeah.
Like, but nowadays, like, I'm so, like, not fazed by it. I never really thought 3D was cool.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought it was, like, kind of lame and an unnecessary step where I could just, like, watch a normal movie and have fun.
I will say we're at a point now where I think the 3D is a lot cooler. You know, it's not that, like, red, blue, lenticular vision that they tried to do for a long time.
That was so, I hated that.
Yeah, it's, like, the 3D that they were trying to bring back at least was somewhat of a natural gimmick. Like, it had an effect to it instead of just giving you a headache.
Yeah.
But yeah, I tend to agree with that.
Yeah.
So I don't have a lot more to add than what you're saying.
I'm pretty good at what I say.
Number three, do you think animated movies are for everybody, or do you think that those are primarily just for younger audiences?
That's easy. I don't really have to say much. They're for everybody.
Yeah.
It's a movie. The movie is made to entertain. And sure, there might be a target audience made for these things, but anyone can identify with any movie.
Yeah, anyone can enjoy it.
You know, that is a very stupid stereotype given to, like, animated movies.
Mm-hmm.
There are certain ones, like, I don't know if you consider Cocomelon or some shit, like, an animated movie, but, like, certain stuff like that is, like, clearly, definitely targeted directly and only for children.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that there will not be, like, adults and other people that won't enjoy it.
Yeah.
Like, they have universal themes that anyone can enjoy, can identify with.
Which is why doing this is so much fun, because it's like movies are so subjective, and it's like movies that we might bash on, there's going to be an audience that says, that was a lot of fun. Why did you guys like it? And that's totally fine. Everybody relates to things differently. And, you know, it's the same with any form of media, whether it be music or video games or books. Like, everybody's got different tastes, and there's an audience out there for all these different kinds of media. But, like, that's why reviewing things is so much fun, because it's like, we get to compare opinions and talk about our differences, and that's kind of a beautiful thing.
And I love the, our different, well, we had basically the same perspective when it came to Malignant.
Yeah.
But our takes on it are far different. We're not than, like, the, a like, lot the popular of vote. Yeah, yeah. No, not at all. And I think we both still feel the same about the movie.
Yeah.
But
I was surprised how many people thought it was a lot of fun.
Like, well, I thought it was a lot of fun too. I think you did too. But like, like awful fun.
Yeah.
Like really bad. And I think people thought that as well. But like, people were more in tune to like, oh man, he was really like doing it on purpose and just wanted to like make like a really bad campy movie.
Yeah.
But you know, to us, we were like, okay, yeah, sure, it's bad and campy, but like, we don't. That's not like what we want.
Yeah. So next. This one seemed odd to me, but I was curious if you were going to have a different answer than I would. What country makes the best movies?
Oh, that's really good. I don't think there really is a good answer to that. I think that that's such a kind of a dumb elitist like question.
Yeah.
But it is like interesting to think about like world cinema in a way.
Yeah. I think what's interesting about the question is that the way it's asked is bad, but I think that it kind of makes an interesting point, which is obviously, I think like here in America, we have the highest budget for movies.
Yeah.
You know, we spend like so much on making and consuming media.
Mm-hmm.
But like even within here in America, we have all these different unique people and different takes on different cultures. You know, it's like, technically they are American movies, but you know, it's like you have these people like, Denis Villeneuve. I can't. So I pronounced both of his names wrong repeatedly, in the last episode.
Denis Villeneuve.
But point being, you know, you have these different, directors and actors that bring unique takes to the cinema that they bring with them from their cultures and their countries.
Yeah.
And so like, even if it's an American movie, it might not be like an American movie, if you know. Yeah. Like, and so I think, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Oh,
fish.
So I was going to say, I think the question is kind of misleading.
Yeah.
Because anybody can make a really good movie, regardless of the country they're from. And they all bring something unique to the table.
Yeah.
It's not like who makes the best movies. It's just about what do we like personally.
Yeah, and clearly it's unfair because like we watch more American movies than any other, you know, nation's movies. Clearly,
yeah.
Like we're American. Like that's a given. But because we watch all these like American movies, like yeah, of course we're gonna have that clear bias there.
So next, number five. Do you think that award movies, like the Oscar bait movies and stuff like that, are movies that actually reflect some of the best of what we've got to offer?
No. We talked about this a little bit last night.
We did. And I think we brought it up and then I saw it on the list and I was like, this will be fun. We just talked about it.
Yeah.
And also, it's something that I think has become more and more relevant as like over the last 5 to 10 years. Like, I think there was a time where they really did try to pick like the best movies of the year. And I think as time goes on, more and more there's these like Oscar bait movies
and the campaigns and all that behind it.
That are not like the best movies of the year. They're just the ones that they know are going to get the Oscars and get like a bunch of exposure.
And let's be real. It all started with Harvey Weinstein. It's all his fault. He started the whole like giant Oscar campaign thing. It was like a lot of it was due to him with like Oscar campaigns for these like smaller indie films, which like great. I'm glad that like indie films are getting their, you know, their just dues and like getting the attention they deserve during award season.
Yeah.
Well, at least in the 90s they were for that. And that did bring like a big boom to independent cinema. But at the same time, you know, Harvey Weinstein's a piece of shit, and he's, like, doing all these awful things while also, like, swaying the Academy voters in, like, a really, like, you know, obvious way, throwing these, like, luxurious parties for them and all that.
Yeah.
So, like, that, the campaigns themselves, I'm not, like, a huge fan of most of the time,
mm-hmm.
but, like you were saying with Oscar bait movies, there's clearly, like, movies that are trying to become, like, to get that Oscar recognition, you know? Movies, and I said this to him last night, it's always, like, movies that are named after a place, or movies that are like, named after a person.
Yeah.
Like a biographic movie. And that's what, like, you know, they're pretty easy to spot, honestly. Like, most of the time, they're, like, really upfront about, like, what they're trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Yesterday, when we were at the movie, the trailer for Belfast came on.
Yeah.
And by the end of that trailer, we were like, well, that's going to be one of those Oscar bait movies.
Yeah, for sure.
Like, you can see it. You can immediately get that feel.
Mm-hmm. And, like, there are certain directors and, like, films that get, like, a lot of recognition for just being great. Like, one of the main ones I noticed was Alfonso Cuarón with, like, his movies. Whenever they get nominated and all that, that's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
That's great. You know, he's, like, he deserves it. He's making all these great movies, and I wouldn't call them Oscar baity at all.
Yeah.
But then, like, you know, directors like Kenneth Branagh making Belfast, like, on the other hand, there you go. Like, that's a complete, like, Oscar bait thing. So, like, clearly there's movies that are, you know, this went on, like, way more of a tangent than I meant to, because, like, the question is, like, how do you feel, like, do you think, like, some Oscar, like, or award movies are deserving of it or something like that?
Yeah, do you think that award movies are actually some of the best that we have to offer?
No, because, like, Green Book won Best Picture. Because, like, what's it called? Black Panther, which, like, I've never seen it, and, you know, I'm not one to judge, like, if it's, like, a good movie or not.
Mm-hmm.
But it won 3 Oscars for very objective things. And I've seen and heard these things. And, like, honestly, they don't seem like something that'd be, like, Oscar worthy. So it's, like, it's much more about, like, the politics behind things, or, like, what these, like, old people that are, like, picking these movies think would be cool, rather than what actually deserves it most of the time.
Yeah.
And a lot of times movies that, like, are great don't even get nominated. Like, The Lighthouse didn't get nominated for, like, anything but cinematography at the Oscars. A total crime.
Total crime. And it's like, you ask pretty much anyone that saw The Lighthouse, except for maybe my wife, and it's unanimously acclaimed for what it does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she sucks. But it's not fair, and then again, it's awards. Like, they're super subjective.
Yeah.
So, you know, but without, like, and I know the Oscars have said that they're, like, trying to, like, diversify their their Academy voters, which is awesome. That's great. But at the same time, I don't know how much I trust the Academy with, like, still, you know, deciding on what's the best movie, you know?
Yeah.
Especially when there's, like, still a lot of movies that, like, aren't even put, like, the fact that in 2019, Parasite winning Best Picture and all these Oscars and all that was such a groundbreaking moment.
Yeah.
It's so weird, because there's been all these, like, great foreign cinema films for years.
Yeah.
That have just, like, not been recognized all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and now, finally, in 2019, it was. Like, that's...
Yeah.
And, like, of course, like, Parasite was definitely deserving of it. Like, even though it wasn't my favorite movie of the year, I still think it was probably, objectively, the best-made movie of the entire year, maybe the decade.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that thing is incredible.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, why'd it take so long, you know? Like, it feels like they don't care half the time, or they don't put, like, certain things into contention.
Yeah. All right, so next up is, this one's a little bit easier. What's your favorite go-to movie snack? Like, if you go see a movie, like, what do you have to have?
Popcorn, you know, if I'm feeling really, really crazy that day, Twizzlers.
Yeah.
That's it.
That's more or less what I do. I get a big popcorn, and I get a big drink. About 90% of the time, it's going to be cherry vanilla Coke.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just kind of the quintessential thing. It's like, big popcorn, big drink.
Mm-hmm.
And Haven likes to get a bunch of candies, and a lot of times she'll, like, pour the candies into the popcorn, and I'm like, I don't like that mixture.
Yeah,
it just needs to be the popcorn.
Yeah. But I get that though.
Yeah. Yeah. But no, so she likes it mixed in with like cookie dough bites and stuff like that, and that's not really my thing. But yeah, that's kind of the, you know, it's the generic thing for like just people in general. You get popcorn at a movie, but it works.
Yeah.
Next is. And again, this is something we talked about a little bit last night. What's the perfect length of a movie? Or, like, what's too long or too short?
My favorite length is between, like, an hour 45 to, like, an hour 50-something.
Mm-hmm.
When it crosses 2 hours, it better be a good movie.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of great movies that, like, last really long. It was, like we were talking about yesterday, like you said, Dune had, like, great pacing. You don't even notice the, like, 2.5 hours. Like, The Irishman had amazing pacing. I didn't notice it was almost 4 hours long, really. Mm-hmm. It was, like, I started watching it when I got off work, and, like, it finished around, like, 11 o'clock, and I was like, oh, shit.
Yeah. But, and the obvious ones are The Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, no, those, like, again, breeze past, because they're so engrossing and entertaining, and they really get you in those worlds.
Yeah.
But it's hard to do that, mm-hmm. you know? It's really hard to get that.
Yeah.
And that's where, like, a lot of movies fail. But, like, my favorite movies are generally in that shorter range where, well, not shorter, but like kind of medium range with like an hour 45 and like before 2 hours, you know, in that range. But I don't like them very short most of the time either, where it's like, it's definitely less of a commitment, but it's not like, you know, I feel like I'm probably going to leave it wanting more.
Yeah.
So
mm-hmm. I think the shortest one I've seen that I came out pretty happy with was The Dirties. Which we talked about a couple weeks ago. It's like, what, 88 minutes or something?
Yeah.
And that's a pretty solid movie.
Barely feature length.
Yeah. So, next question, number 8. What is your favorite sequel?
Oh, that's really good.
And I figure, like, you know, loose term of sequel. Like, any movie in a franchise, I guess.
That's hard, because, like, now I want to look for sequels. I'm going to look for movie sequels real quick.
I mean, so for me, I think it would probably be maybe Aliens.
Mm-hmm.
Or the third Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade.
That's a great one.
That's a really good one.
Oh, you know what? Okay. You know what it might be? Shrek 2. I
wondered if that
Shrek
would come
2.
Up. Yeah.
That's one of my favorite things.
I don't know if it's technically like a sequel so much as like a spiritual. It's set in the same, you know, it's the same character, same universe, but it's not like a numbered sequel or anything. But Mad Max Fury Road is like one of my favorite movies.
That's one of the ones that came up when I looked up.
Is it?
Thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I full on thought you were talking about Shrek 2 for a second. I was like, it literally has two in the name. What do you mean?
No, I love Mad Max Fury Road.
Yeah. Terminator 2.
Yeah.
T2, Judgment Day.
Mm-hmm.
I really love T2.
Lots of good options.
Yeah. But,
I think I'd probably stick with Aliens. I think Aliens is one of the best sequels.
I still haven't seen Aliens. And, like, I don't know if I'd really be super into it, honestly.
Really?
Because, like, it's just, like, that genre is not really my thing. James mm-hmm. Cameron movies aren't really my thing.
It doesn't necessarily feel like other James Cameron movies. If that makes a difference.
That probably would make a difference, honestly. Yeah.
To me, because it definitely is not nearly the same film as, you know, Titanic or Avatar, those kinds of movies. It's not anything like that.
Yeah. Avatar, dude, the more I think about Avatar, the more I think it sucks. Like, it's really not an Avatar.
It's all visuals, which is cool. Yeah. It's a beautiful movie.
But the story's just stupid.
Yeah, it's very generic. It's not a very good movie. It's just, it's all eye candy.
Exactly, yeah.
Which is what I said about Sucker Punch the first time I saw it.
Mm-hmm.
Sucker Punch is like, that. I think that's like Zack Snyder at like peak Snyder.
Uh-huh.
Like visually, it just, it wants to please your eyes with every single frame.
Yeah.
But there is no substance behind it at all.
That's funny because I think Sucker Punch is a very hideous movie.
Really?
Yeah, visual wise, I'm not a fan of. Yeah, I'm not a fan of Zack Snyder's visuals. I don't like the grungy, dark, drab look. I think it's gross. I don't find it fun to watch.
Yeah.
It,
like, no, I enjoyed the look of it at least.
This looks stupid.
But we kind of delved out of sequels a little bit. We're just talking about movies now.
Yeah, sure. That's always how it happens.
Number nine. Do you have like an indicator for what's going to be a good movie? Do you look at like the director or like a specific actor or like a certain plot? Like what draws you in and makes you think, okay, this is going to be a good movie?
Generally, it's not actors. It's, although I do trust some, like many actors in like picking good roles.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the time it is director or like writer, maybe studio behind it. But most of the time, I don't really know until I get into it, because like there was a time before where like I'd kind of like just be like, yeah, of course it's gonna be a good movie, look who made it,
yeah,
and all that. But now, like over the past like couple years, I've been like kind of continuously let down by a few movies,
mm-hmm.
and like what we're about to talk about with Last Night in Soho, where I was like, you know, sure, this is gonna be great and like a fun genre movie, and I get into it and like, you know, if I start to feel like things are predictable,
mm-hmm.
or like usually with dialogue or like screenplay wise, like you can see it playing out in front of you, and it's like, if it's not what you want, then generally it's like off the bat, then generally it's just gonna end up being bad for
yeah.
you yourself. You don't, because you don't know who is gonna like who it could please. But for me, like, that's generally how I figure it out. Like, in the first, like, 20 or so minutes,
yeah.
I'll be like, all right, this is probably something I'm not going to love.
Yeah. All right. So, number 10. Do you enjoy subtitled movies?
Yes, but I do have trouble with, because, like, I want to watch the images. I want to watch, like, the visual aspects of it.
Yeah.
But then my eyes are, of course, drawn to the subtitles.
That's
I have to look at that. So
that's exactly the problem that I have. Yeah.
Me.
Because it's like you want to take in the whole movie and you're just watching, you're basically watching the plot.
Yeah, exactly.
And you miss so much of like any visual flair
yeah.
it might have.
There's certain movies that like are foreign films that I've seen enough times where like I don't really need to look at the subtitles to like, you know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I can just kind of like follow along with just like looking at the visuals, like Violent.
Yeah.
But like the last one that I had like that kind of trouble with was E Tu Mama Tambien,
mm-hmm.
Alfonso Cuarón's movie.
Yeah.
And man, that one, like, I was getting kind of annoyed because I like find myself just like constantly reading, because there's a lot of dialogue in that movie, just
yeah.
constantly reading, and I'd look up and I'd be like, oh, that was a cool shot and I didn't really get to see most of it.
Mm-hmm.
Dang it.
Because it is, it's like you're down here and
yeah.
you like glance up and see something quick, and then you gotta glance back down to like
yeah.
read the story again.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's kind of the same problem that I have a lot of times, but depending on how bad any sort of dub might be, it's
yeah.
worth just dealing with the subtitles.
When it comes to like something like Evangelion, which I absolutely love,
mm-hmm.
I'm okay with listening to dub and all that. Like most
yeah.
of the time, if it's like an animated movie, I'm fine with the dub. I don't, it doesn't bother me.
Mm-hmm.
So like, you know.
Okay. All right. Number 11. What turns you off of a movie, like, immediately? Like, if you're watching a movie, what just either pulls you out of it or makes you turn it off?
Dialogue. It
okay.
is 90% of the time it's going to be dialogue. If it's dialogue that I find, like, cringy or, like, unrealistic in a
mm-hmm.
way, yeah, that's generally it. Most of the things I can put up with.
Yeah.
Like, visuals, audio, stuff like that. But if I find the dialogue just like off-putting and stupid,
mm-hmm.
then that's where it just ends for me. Like with a movie like, oh, how am I struggling to remember the name of the year? Spectacular Men.
Yeah.
If that movie had better dialogue, I wouldn't have given a shit.
Mm-hmm.
But because like it has the worst dialogue ever.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of really hard to watch.
Almost incomprehensible.
Yeah,
sometimes.
Almost incomprehensible. So like,
because they have these
yeah.
lines that I think they think are quotable, but in reality just don't make any sense and confuse the audience.
Yeah, like when we were reading the quotes on
yeah.
IMDb. Yeah, that was it's frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's usually it. Like if you don't have good dialogue, you don't have engaging dialogue, or then I'm just probably gonna turn it off after a while.
Yeah,
if it doesn't get any better, because sometimes it can get better.
Yeah,
but you know, more often than not, it doesn't.
Mm-hmm. And finally, before we wrap this up, what's your most anticipated upcoming movie?
Darren Aronofsky's The Whale. which is coming out next year, I think.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited for that. Okay. Brendan Fraser comeback, probably. Yeah. Knowing Darren Aronofsky, probably going to have a comeback with that. Yeah, I'm excessively excited.
Yeah. I think for me, the big one I was looking forward to was Last Night in Soho.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that in a minute. But I'm struggling right now to think of one, like, another one coming up that I was this hyped for. Because it was Edgar Wright, I was like, okay, this is going to be a blast. This is going to be the movie I talk about for a long time. And, I mean, I guess in a way it is going to be a movie I talk about for a long time. But
yeah.
I don't know. I can't think of another one off the top of my head because it's also saturated with just, like, the blockbuster movies.
Yeah. Sometimes you gotta, like, scroll through Letterboxd because they'll have, like, a list of, like, people will make lists of, like, upcoming new movies that are, like, really exciting. There's one that
had a
bunch of stuff, like Darren Aronofsky's The Whale, where it's, like, not giant blockbusters, but, like, you know, character studies or, like, things coming from, like, acclaimed directors.
Yeah. There are some current movies that I've heard about that have kind of got me excited. Mm-hmm. I don't know about, like, upcoming, but I haven't seen Lamb yet, and everybody's been talking about Lamb
for a while.
And I'm like, okay, that's kind of got me a little bit excited. I want to know what that's about because I want to go in blind.
Not a lamb, duh.
What I've heard is that you don't want to know anything about it. I haven't even watched the trailer.
Yeah.
I know the name of the movie, and I think it's in black and white.
It's not.
It's not? No. Okay. But everybody says, like, try not to get spoilers, try not to go in with any knowledge. And so that's what I'm doing. But, like, everybody is just saying, this is the weirdest movie, and it's gonna like, mess you up.
Yeah.
And so go in without knowing anything. Yeah. And so I'm kind of excited for that. A lot of people have said The Last Duel is pretty good, but...
Yeah. I heard that was bombing right now, which is kind of sad.
Yeah.
It's Ridley Scott, so no matter what, people are going to give him a lot of money.
Yeah, and I mean, I like Ridley Scott.
Me too, yeah.
Even
though it does feel weird to have Matt Damon playing someone, like, medieval. Anyway, for some reason. I only picture him as, like, a Boston ruffian.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then... But I mean, yeah, it's like, the upcoming ones that I know about are all, like, you know, the superhero movies and stuff like that. And I'm like, oh, I'll see those eventually.
Yeah.
But I'm having trouble, like, working up hype for, like, for, like, Eternals and Morbius and all this stuff. It's like, oh.
They look so bad. They look awful. So I hate movies like that. I don't know if we've talked about that at all. But they're not for me at all. I hate them. I'm the opposite of, like, anyone else you've had on the podcast. Mm. So
I don't, I don't mind them. I can enjoy them for what they are. And I had, like, a lot of fun with them when it first started. They just saturated the market so much that I'm starting to hit a little bit of a
wall.
Yeah. A little bit of a breakdown there where I'm like, it's too much.
Yeah.
It's hard to keep up with everything.
Yeah.
It's just tiring instead of, like, exciting now. Mm. But yeah, so those are coming, and I guess it's a little bit of a cheat, but because it's not upcoming, it's like a present movie that's already out. But I think right now the next one I'm excited to see is Lamb. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
But, all right.
Is that it?
Yeah. Oh, cool. That was our 12 questions. So now
it only took us 2 hours.
Yeah. Well, I think it really probably took us what, about a half hour?
Yeah.
It's just there were so many stops to because of a baby.
Ah, two men and a baby.
Yeah. But anyway, everything's taken care of now. The baby's good. We're good. We're back in our groove.
Yes.
And our movie for this week was Last Night in Soho, which I know for a while we were doing two movies and we would double down and these would end up being like 2 hours or more long.
Yeah.
And now that we're just doing one movie, they're coming closer to like about an hour, a little over an hour.
Yeah.
Which I think that's pretty good too.
That's good. Yeah.
As most of you probably know, we use our own custom WAPMaster index to score our movies. If this is your first time listening or watching or you're not familiar, the WAPMaster is a rating index that we came up with.
You came up with.
I came up with. It breaks it down into 10 different domains that cover different technical aspects of the film. We'll cover them as we go, but each letter in WAPMaster covers a different topic of filmmaking and what we thought about each aspect. And we can give up to 10 points in each category for a collective score of up to 100 or as low as 10. Mm-hmm. And we've never had one as low as 10. We've gotten pretty close. But we've never had one that's actually hit 10. We've never had one that's actually hit 100. We've had one that was 14. And I think we had one that hit like 92, if I remember right.
On an episode that we didn't air, I think Black Swan for me hit like a 95.
Okay. But yeah.
So, yeah.
So we've gotten pretty close, but we have yet to find that elusive, like, best or worst movie ever created. But anyway, so first letter in WAPMASTER is W. That stands for writing. Is the film well-written, clever, and cohesive? Are there plot holes, cringeworthy dialogue, or unmotivated moments just to squeeze in a gag or sexual encounter? Would you like to go first, or would you like me to?
You usually go first, so you go.
Okay. It's... So just in general with this review, I fought with this one a lot because of my own personal bias toward Edgar Wright's films. I gave the writing for this a 5. I think it went pretty middle of the road. I think that for every moment that kind of captured a time or a place or a moment that I liked, and I think that there were really good moments, especially like in the 60s. He captured that atmosphere like really well, especially at the beginning, or not the very beginning, but like, so like maybe 30 minutes in, I was sold. And I was like, this is it. This is where it comes into its own. And this is where it's going to be good. And then it all started kind of falling apart for me again later on. But about 30 minutes in, it all clicked and the dialogue was good. The visuals were cool. And I was really digging it. And it's like, I think if this were made by someone else, it probably would have gotten a higher rating. I think I can say that too, because it's disappointing for an Edgar Wright film.
Definitely.
But I think it's slightly better than a lot of the really garbage horror films that I watch too.
Yeah.
And so I think if it weren't an Edgar Wright movie, I might give it like a 6 or 7. I might be a little bit more forgiving, but I know his potential and what he's capable of and his own pedigree there.
Yeah.
And so I think I graded it almost a little bit more harshly because of that. Especially like for the surrounding cast. So like Thomasin McKenzie, Anya Taylor-Joy, Matt Smith, they were all great. They're acting. I mean, we'll talk about more. They're acting more in a little bit, but like, I think the writing for them was all pretty good. The roommate,
Jocasta.
Jocasta. I don't feel like she even fit in this movie.
The most like cookie cutter mean girl character ever.
I feel like she would have felt more in line in Mean Girls than in this movie.
And, like, it was weird because she was like a big part of it in the beginning and then like went away for a while and she would occasionally pop up, but it felt so inconsequential every single time.
But then at the end too, there's like this come to Jesus moment where she actually talks about how brave our hero was and how great she is and all that. But there's no payoff for that. There's no reason for her to have a change of heart. You know, she was such a minor character and she was so mean the whole way through that there's no reason she should all of a sudden be nice. Now.
She's kind of annoying.
And it was the same with like the would-be boyfriend. And I guess before we go any further, I should go ahead and say this is going to be really spoiler heavy. I'm not going to hold back on this just because of inherently like the way that this story went and the twist in it.
Kind of has to be.
I'm not gonna like pull my punches or try to like be like, okay, this part's a spoiler warning, but this part's not. I'm just going to let you know if you're watching or listening to this episode, just expect it. We're just going to talk about it. The boyfriend too, or not the boyfriend, but like the guy John. That she's sometimes with. He's a nothing character. He's there to be like, hey, are you okay? Talk to me. And then he's gone again for a while. And then he comes back and he's like, hey, I like you. You should come talk to me and hang out with me. And then he's gone again. And that was just so frustrating because I know that Edgar Wright is normally so good about creating these characters. His characters in his movies are normally so lived in. And these just like nothing cookie cutter characters made me so frustrated.
I feel that.
And they were all unnecessary to the movie and the twist and all that. Like, you could have cut like 3 characters from this movie and it would have been just as good, if not better.
It feels like a lot of the subplots ended up going nowhere, but I gave it a 4, by the way. And like, because I had it at a 5 originally, and then like and I gave it the benefit of the doubt on a lot of my ratings.
Mm-hmm.
And then once I got to the overall score, I was like, that is not the score I feel comfortable with. I do not like this movie that much.
Yeah.
And so I had to like go back and rethink a few things and bump a few things down. And writing mm-hmm. was one of them.
Yeah.
I had the writing at a 6 originally.
Okay.
Because like they have these little moments of comedy in it.
Yeah.
Where like I genuinely think it's funny. There's some mm-hmm. like good comedic moments. But they're, you know, of course this is like more of a genre film like we were talking
yeah.
about, where they don't want those comedic bits
and
as
that's
much.
What and that's what Edgar Wright normally excels in. That's where he got his start with even like Spaced back
yeah.
when he was doing TV with mm-hmm. like Simon Pegg and Nick Frost.
Yeah.
You know, they've always been like this. He's always been great with comedy, mm-hmm. and he throws that in so heavily in all of his projects. Even Baby Driver, which was a little bit of a departure from his normal like
yeah.
comedy
which is
hybrids.
Great, by the way,
Baby Driver is a fantastic movie.
Yeah.
But it's also like a like crime thriller.
Mm-hmm.
And it blends those so well.
And the characters in Baby Driver are so rich.
Again,
they're
yeah.
amazing.
The characters are so good that it makes it so much more disappointing. Because mm-hmm. it's not like this came along and it's like, oh, he needs to stick to like his comedy hybrids.
Yeah.
He made a really good like genre piece.
Which had less comedy in it than most of his other films. Too.
Yeah. He made it, so this Baby Driver was not a comedy. It
no.
was a crime thriller mm-hmm. first and foremost that still had really good comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows that he can do it. That potential is there, which makes it even more maddening that Last Night in Soho dropped so hard.
Yeah. Like, and a lot of the writing felt really predictable too.
Yeah.
I think like going into it, it was kind of obvious where it was going to go immediately.
Yeah. I made a note
yeah.
in my list, you know, I've been making like little bullets.
Yeah.
And one of my notes was it felt about as predictable as like a Disney animated movie.
Yeah, exactly. Like
the,
you know, the structure going into it.
You
this.
Know, the structure and the plot points and even the twists that are coming, you know,
oh my God,
the,
yeah.
the big reveals. It was like, oh, okay.
yeah. Like I kind of like, and it's not, I don't know if it, I don't know if this is just me, but like, I kind of had an inkling for like what they were trying to do. Like the cop guy was clearly a red herring from
mm-hmm.
the beginning.
Yeah.
That was obvious. And,
yeah.
But like, you know, didn't exactly know, where the twist was going to go until the scene started, because the scene, like the scene where they're going to reveal it, because the scene is so obvious.
Mm-hmm.
Like the way they set it up, it's so clear what they're going to do with it from the beginning. Even if it's like a longer scene,
yeah,
you know it's coming, because like it's so blatant. It's so right there on the screen.
Yeah. And they do
yeah.
it. It's not even one of those where it's like, you know, they kind of cleverly, like discreetly hide things
mm-hmm.
So that you find them out throughout this scene and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's like they kind of try to keep it really discreet and hidden for a long time.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden this scene rolls around and they like throw a bunch of really obvious flags in your face so
yeah.
that you realize it like way before the character, but like just in time to know before the character.
Yeah.
So you can be like, oh, I saw it coming. But it still didn't work because
no.
the character is so clearly portrayed like from the beginning that it's like, you kind of know what you're in for.
Yeah.
Which again, I think in a different movie, it would be like, okay, it was a little bit predictable, but it was at least executed pretty well.
Uh-huh.
But with Edgar Wright's pedigree behind, you know, just with his repertoire
yeah, he
behind
carries
him,
this, like certain.
Yeah,
well,
it's like
too.
You want your expectations to be subverted. You have this idea of like, he's not gonna do this.
Yeah.
And then whenever he did everything you expected from like the first 15 minutes of the movie,
yeah.
it was just so disappointing.
Yeah, whereas like a movie like Hot Fuzz kind of plays on that tropey kind of feeling with the,
yeah.
a lot of the characters. And still like somehow is able to subvert it and tip it on its head.
Yeah.
Like the entire time. This one is so on the nose. And that's something that like I've kind of felt immediately going into it, was like, man, this dialogue is like really on the nose and clear about like what it's trying to be.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's no hiding it, and that was really disappointing going into it.
Yeah.
Even though the twists like I couldn't, you know, I didn't exactly see them coming from a mile away,
mm-hmm.
they were still very clear and upfront, like the ending twist with Miss Collins being Sandy. Everyone saw that coming. How
yeah.
could you not see that coming? Like
yeah.
that's so, and like the whole thing with the tea. She's like, "Drink your tea." Like Yeah, we know, like, okay, that tea's clearly gonna be, like,
poisoned or drugged or whatever.
Something. Yeah, like, it's, and then, like, the ending felt like such a non-ending.
Yeah.
It felt like I didn't get any closure. It kind of, and it went exactly where I was, like, thinking it would go, but I was hoping, like, going into it, I was like, please don't let the ending be, like, this generic, like, Hallmark movie ending.
Yeah.
And it was exactly that, generic Hallmark movie ending.
Mm-hmm.
And that really took a lot, like, it took the wind out of me, man, when that ended. I was like, oh, God.
Yeah.
Come on.
It was also very much like a message movie, which I mentioned to you at, like, right after when the credits were rolling.
Yeah.
And you were kind of like, oh my gosh, it was.
Yeah.
Like, it was very, like, blatantly in your face, like, kind of a critique or, like, a really scathing, like, commentary. Which is fine,
especially after, like, his last film being Baby Driver, having Kevin Spacey in it.
Yeah.
It makes sense, you know?
So it was very much like, don't. It was very much about, like, the use and abuse of, like, women in the entertainment industry.
Yes, yeah.
That was very clear. And it felt very relevant because, you know, this was being worked on and at least in as conceptually in his mind and in the writers' minds when, you know, like, the Weinstein stuff was going down and things like
most
that.
Most likely, yeah.
I would think. And so with all of this, the culture and the Hollywood movements and stuff the way they are right now, it felt like a very scathing commentary on just, like, current affairs as well as the way things were back in the 60s.
Which
is fine.
Which does need to be said.
Yeah.
And more, especially more mainstream
films. It does need to be said, and I think if it's going to be done, this at least did it more deftly than some other movies we've seen. I know I keep bringing up Wonder Woman 1984, but it just drove me so nuts in that movie. Just how in your face it was, and it, like, pulled you out of the immersion. This doesn't do that.
Yeah.
It's still entertainment first and foremost, but it is very clearly, like, a message movie.
Yeah, definitely.
But it does feel like it kind of batters you over the head a little bit sometime. Have you seen... So there's, like, a retro, like, SNL sketch about...
I never watch anything from SNL.
Okay. So the whole bit is that... I think it was Will Ferrell. Is sitting around the table with his family, and they're talking about how they can't save money and how they keep spending money.
Yeah.
And then a guy comes in and just, like, clearly says, don't spend money you don't have. And then, you know, it becomes like this dumb humor thing where Will Ferrell's like, well, what if I really want to get a new boat? And the guy's like, well, you can't because you don't have that money.
Uh-huh.
And then, like, his wife is like, well, but what if I really want to spend money? And he's like, well, don't spend money you don't have. You know, so on and so forth. It's just this really, like, just kind of dumb, broad humor, you know?
Yeah.
That's kind of what it felt like with this movie sometimes. It felt like it was, like, the movie was saying, hey, but don't rape women.
Yeah.
and then they're like, but what if we really want to rape women? Yeah. No, you shouldn't rape women, so don't do that.
That's not okay.
Yeah, that's kind of what it felt like. And I was like, even during the movie, that's kind of what it reminded me of. And I was like, you know that that's bad when it's reminding me of, like, an SNL comedy sketch.
Yeah, oh my God.
But that's kind of what the intent it got across by the end.
Yeah.
And it even had, like, this almost... At first, I was like, wait, are they, like, defending this? Because there was almost, like, this weird payoff where all of the ghosts of these men that had, like, forced themselves on Sandy throughout the movie were sympathetic for a second. Yeah, they were, like, begging for help and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I don't like that. Like, what are they doing here? But then they kind of turn it back around, and, like, the girls kind of have this
kind of subversion we were talking about.
Yeah, don't do that. But then they have this, like, turnaround again where it's like, you know, it cuts back to the two girls back in the present, you know, and they're like, I never wanted this. They, you know, they were never the victims, you know, so on and so forth. And I was like, okay, well, at least they're coming back to what's important here.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was not a lot good to say about the writing.
No, not at all. again, like, maybe the best thing you can say is, like, there were some good comedic beats.
Yeah, there were some good comedic beats. And like I said,
And they were well-placed, I think.
From about 30 minutes in to about 50 minutes in, I would say, there was some good, like, kind of 60s dialogue, and it felt very, like, thematic and in the moment. Like,
yeah, like, when it kicked into...
it caught its mojo there for a little bit.
Yeah, like, when she was falling asleep and then, like, you know, seeing all this stuff with Anya Taylor-Joy...
And the quick cuts, like, having one of them in the mirror while the other one is with Matt Smith.
Yeah.
And then, like, you know, he dips her in the dance, and then they comes back up, and it's the other person.
Yeah, that was really cool.
And was that... I was trying to figure out, were those, like, really clever cuts, or were they actually swapping off actresses
during the scene? By the way it was looking, and by the way they dipped out of frame, I'm assuming they were swapping out actresses.
Because that was really well done. Yeah, that choreography was boss if they actually did that.
They did. But, like, once it kicks into, I was starting to get a little sold too for a while.
Yeah.
When it kicked into the 60s stuff, when she's like falling asleep and then going into that world.
Yeah.
And like you see, Anya Taylor-Joy walking down the staircase and you got that cool sequence mirror next to her. And you see, Thomasin McKenzie in that
just
that
experiencing
mirror.
It that's kind super of watching cool.
Yeah.
And it shows like that dynamic between the two of them, because she's supposed to be like this shy, quiet country girl, and that kind of dynamic and that juxtaposition of seeing her in the mirror, watching this mirror image of herself being like more confident and following her dreams. I was like, oh, this is good. Yeah. This is going to show, like, character growth as she becomes more, like, a more confident fashion designer, and it starts translating to her being a more self-assured person in her current life, you know, and all this. Yeah. Like, I was anticipating all of this, like, great stuff happening that never panned out based on these, like, two or three really good scenes.
Yeah. And then after, but the thing is, after, like, a while, it did feel like every time that, like, something would build up in that sequence, it felt like it got immediately torn down after a little bit because of some sort of dialogue mix up or trip along the way.
Yeah.
Where I'd just be like, okay, well, like, I wish they didn't say that, or I wish they didn't do this right there, because like if they continued doing this other thing, it would have been perfect.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I don't know. I guess there's only so much you can do.
Yeah.
In those moments, but man, it feels like they really missed out on a few like really good bits.
So we've kind of gone off on some tangential stuff here.
Yeah.
That was just writing.
Yeah, that was only writing.
that was supposed to just be like the writing aspect. We kind of went off on a little bit more that we'll talk about more later.
Yeah.
But for writing, overall, I gave it a 5. You said a 4.
Yep.
So next up is Heart. Some movies revel in their own bad intent. We watch movies with heart to make us feel things. Does the movie compel us, inspire us, or make us think? Do we learn or grow from it, or is it forgettable and or too despicable for its own good? I was forgiving with this one.
Mm-hmm.
I gave it a 6.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the movie, I didn't come out feeling real strongly for the characters or anything.
Yeah.
But it also feels irresponsible of me to rate it too low, considering the important subject matter that it touches on.
Yeah.
I think it does have important things to say, and I think it deserves some credit for the message it's trying to get across. But it doesn't really deserve credit for, like, really, like, emboldening me or making me feel things.
Yeah. Good thing you say that. I gave it a 1.
Oh, okay.
No, I'm just kidding. I gave it a 5.
Oh, all right.
But yeah.
Either way, I wouldn't have been too surprised.
because, like, I think, like you were saying, it does have that, like, bedrock, that little foundation of just, like, you know, really important subject matter.
Yeah.
But it's tainted by just having these...
This kind of mediocre movie surrounding it.
Yeah, this movie that, like, doesn't make me feel anything but, like, a little frustrated.
Yeah.
But not in, like, the good kind of way. Not the kind of frustrated where, like, oh, dang it, this is so good.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, this is just a letdown. And I don't care about these characters. I don't really care for the world they're in. Like, it doesn't capture my imagination really in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And, the heart behind it doesn't really... And I can see Edgar Wright's love for the 60s in this. And, like, the music and all that, the time period. But it also feels like they approached it in a very kind of generic way half the time that didn't feel like they put their own imagination or spin on anything, really. And that, again, takes away from the heart that I felt in the film.
Yeah. So next up is A for acting. This category covers the obvious, the performances by at least the primary cast. I gave this an 8. I think that at least the primary cast was a lot of fun to watch. I think Thomas and Mackenzie, Anya Taylor-Joy, and Matt Smith, I talked about it a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
But I think they brought a lot to the screen themselves. Mm-hmm. And then beyond that, there was nothing. But, like, you know, covering just the primary characters, I think they did admirable with what they were given as far as the script. Uh-huh. But outside of that, everything else kind of fell flat. Mm-hmm. Everyone else was either cookie cutter or just a non-character that was there to advance the plot.
Yeah.
But I think the actors that they had that had plot points and character development were really good.
I gave this a 5.
Okay.
Because, I think the best actor in this is Anya Taylor-Joy.
Mm-hmm.
I think that she's kind of got this, like, this kind of stoicism. Or is that even a word? She's got this stoic feeling in the beginning, and you really feel that confidence like oozing out of her. And then once she's like meeting Matt Smith, you know, you can feel her kind of getting swooned and being like lulled into the sense of comfortability.
Yeah,
going into this world, and then right when it all crashes down on her, you could feel like the kind of nihilistic dread.
She definitely has the most nuanced, acting.
She gets a lot across in this.
Yeah.
But when I get to Matt Smith, I liked him at first. But then I think a lot of the dialogue and all that really lets him down. Because in the end, he just turns into someone going like, "Where do you think you're going?" Yeah. And like constantly like pointing and stuff like that. And just saying this like kind of this generic bad guy dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
Thomas and Mackenzie, I thought, was just okay. Because like, again, she doesn't have like the best stuff to work with.
Yeah.
She's playing this like quirky country girl who's like, "Oh, fish out of water."
Mm-hmm.
And that's like the most I get out of her. Like, I don't really like, I don't see a whole lot more nuance in her performance outside of that.
Yeah.
And then like you were saying, everyone else, I thought that the guy that played John, while, I don't think he was particularly good and I don't think his dialogue was very good, I thought that he had, yeah, exactly. I thought he had like a good, like charming feeling behind him. And he was like kind of adorable to watch on screen.
Yeah.
I liked seeing it when he came on screen. I was always like, "You want sweet John, yeah.
You want her to come around."
I liked him because he's just like a nice guy.
Yeah.
But this kind of goes to the writing again. I found this hilarious when the guy got hit by a car, Lindsay, when he got hit by a car, and Thomas and Mackenzie runs into a phone booth and is like calling her Nan, and then like for some reason the sirens and all that are around. For some reason, John just like assumes that something's going on with Thomas, and he's like running through the streets like. Like, oh, what was her name?
Eloise.
He's like, Ellie, like running through the street shouting it instead of like calling her or something like that. Like, what are you doing? Running? Mm-hmm. And she just happens to see him and being like, "Oh, John."
Yeah.
Like, it was stupid. And but that was dumb.
Well, I can understand where that came from because she was on shift at that pub.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but he's running through the street. Like, Like, that's dumb. Like, mm-hmm. Come on, that's dumb.
Yeah.
But yeah, like any other character didn't care about at all. Jocasta was awful, so unlikable, and had no character arc whatsoever. One really had a character arc in this.
Jocasta wasn't even like a good unlikable. It's not even like earlier I said Mean Girls, and maybe that was giving her too much credit
mm-hmm.
because at least in Mean Girls, even the Mean Girls have like kind of a character to them, and like some witty dialogue and stuff like that. She doesn't even have that.
No,
she's not even
all.
Like. Unlikable in the way that you love to hate him or anything. She's just actually just not a good,
just awful.
Yeah.
But I think I said no one had a character arc. Anya Taylor-Joy had a character arc.
Mm-hmm.
She definitely did, and she was really she was like, I think she was really good in this, but everyone else though, very middle of the road at best, if not outright bad.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I don't blame them on the caliber of actor most of the time, more so just the writing falling apart for them.
So next is P for production design. Do sets and costumes fit the genre and time period? Does makeup portray the situation, or does the beaten down hero still look perfectly coiffed while lying in the dirt? This is where I was able to give it some credit. I gave this one just a straight up 10.
Yeah.
I think that this is where Edgar Wright's directing did kind of shine through.
Yeah.
These kind of like... surrealist angles and the outfits and the color saturation, and just everything about it looked really good.
Uh-huh.
I liked the costumes. I liked the settings. I liked a lot of what I saw. Like, visually, it was so good.
Uh-huh.
And so that one I was able to pretty easily give a 10. And I mean, considering it's set around like the fashion world and stuff, you would hope for that.
Yeah.
But that kind of marriage of, you know, the modern outfits with like the 60s stylings. Mm-hmm. And these like extravagant like dance halls and ballrooms and stuff like that. It was a joy to look at.
I gave this a 6.
Okay.
Because while I thought that the 60s moments, they did a pretty good job transforming everything into the 60s, it also did feel like a little uninspired at times, because like while the sets around them would be, you know, pretty cool, cool niche 60s looking. A lot of the costuming outside of Anya Taylor-Joy didn't really do much for me, because like the dudes, like granted they probably would be wearing this in like the actual 60s in Soho,
mm-hmm.
But they were just only wearing like all the same suits. And like anytime you were not in the 60s and in like the regular world, everything felt like so uninspired. Like, and it being set in the fashion world, I was hoping for a lot more, but it didn't really give me anything. Yeah. Like, everything felt so bare bones. Like, this is just kind of like, yeah, this is what this is, mm-hmm. kind of thing, and not like any cool like hints towards stuff like that. I bring up Black Swan a lot. I know that.
Yeah.
And part of the amazing production design in that film is Nina's bedroom.
Mm-hmm.
Where you get so much out of her character by just looking at her bedroom.
Both of them. Yeah. Her bedroom and her mom's bedroom.
Yeah, exactly. Where, like, Nina's bedroom is her being, like, stuck in this childish phase and being kind of controlled by her mother. And her mother's bedroom being Nina. It's just being only Nina and, like, showing that she's her entire world, basically. Mm-hmm. Whereas here, the most character we really get out of Thomasin McKenzie with the production design and everything is like at the beginning she's got these homemade clothes which you know, very on the nose and look exactly like what you'd want them to be. Like, literally when I saw them, when we first see her, she's in a dress that she made out of newspaper.
Yeah.
And that's like, again, really on the nose. Mm-hmm. And then when she's turning into trying to mimic Anya Taylor-Joy, She just gets the hair and wears the coat, and that's like it. Like, yeah. And there's not a whole lot more to it. Like, it's stuff that we've already seen in the mm-hmm. film. So while I think that the 60s stuff is done pretty well, for the most part,
mm-hmm.
whereas like I can give the 60s stuff in general a 6, and Anya Taylor-Joy, if I was only judging on Anya Taylor-Joy's character and how she's done, I'd probably give it like a 9. But because of everything else around it being so lackluster, keeping it at a 6.
Okay, that's fair.
You know.
Yeah. All right, next up is M for marketing. Many movies give away too much or not enough, use poor music choices, or just don't do enough marketing to get people excited for their film. Were we excited to see the film, and why or why not? I gave this one an 8. Mm-hmm. I think the trailers looked really cool.
Yeah.
And the trailers made me so excited.
Yeah.
And they showed off this movie that was going to be so much more surreal and subversive and exciting than it actually ended up being, which made it even more disappointing that, you know, after seeing the movie. Mm-hmm. But just based on the trailers, I would have thought that it was great.
Yeah. With the trailer, I also gave it an 8. With the trailers, they kind of gave off this feeling of like, this movie is super for real. This is super serious.
Yeah.
And knowing Edgar Wright, he very rarely does stuff like that, where he's like, you know, talking about, or where he's like doing these like super serious films.
Yeah.
If almost never.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's moments like that in Baby Driver, but like in most of his other films, they're super, you know, surreal comedies.
Yeah.
But the movie we actually got was not that. It didn't take itself nearly as seriously as the trailers made it seem like it was going to be.
Mm-mm.
And I was really excited to see him, like, again, with the subversive stuff. Like,
yeah,
we do not expect that from Edgar Wright, and we ended up not getting what we didn't expect. We ended up getting more of, like, you know, kind of what we would expect to see, but at like a lower level. Mm-hmm. And that was very disappointing. But the trailers themselves and like the artwork and everything, the neon and all that, super cool. I love that. And I was very excited for it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, too bad it didn't live up.
Yeah. Next up is A for audio. This covers the orchestration and song choices and whether they enhance or elevate the film, as well as just sound design in general.
Yeah.
I gave this a 7. Mm-hmm. I think I normally always love Wright's music choices.
Yeah.
And I think I really liked the actual, like, deliberate music choices in this movie, too. But with that said, there was some incidental audio in here that did not work for me.
Yeah.
I think there were some moments where he didn't want, like, his actual music. He wanted it to be, like, you know, background music. Uh-huh. And it devolved into just, like, this, you know, thumping, chaotic background music to show that, you know, she our main character, Eloise, is having a breakdown or something. Yeah. Or Eloise is running away from Matt Smith or something like that. And the music there is just bad.
Mm-hmm.
And it is. That made me so mad because normally I really, even the orchestra or orchestral stuff in like Shaun of the Dead and Scott Pilgrim and stuff like that is really good.
Yeah.
On top of having actual like music choices that are really good.
Mm-hmm.
And here it's like, I think his like 60s music choices were really good.
Yeah.
But the incidental music was not.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree.
So I gave it a 7.
I gave it a 6 because, again, like I really love, especially the, like the first half with the music choices that he was choosing and all that, really put you in mm-hmm. that world and everything. Although I did find it kind of cheesy that she, like the that Thomas and McKenzie was like super into these 60s tracks, but it makes sense because like listening to an Edgar Wright interview, he said that like that's what he was listening to growing up, and that's like his parents loved that,
mm-hmm.
and that's why he's so into it.
Yeah.
So it makes sense, but it feels like after a certain point, all the music gets a little repetitive and kind of a little bit too on the nose, like with the song literally called Eloise and like the creepy guy that was a cop, like mm-hmm. for some reason is playing that song and being like super weird like that. And then like you were saying, the original score is just downright bad. It's not good. It doesn't really even put you in the mood that they're trying to get you in. It's just like, it's noticeably not good.
Mm-hmm.
But the sound design itself is a pretty actually pretty good.
Yeah.
When it came to like the moments where she's being overwhelmed by these spirits and all that, there were times where I don't know if you noticed, because I'd turn my head really quick because like I thought like the sound was swirling around us so much.
Yeah.
I thought that there was like just people in the theater talking, mm-hmm. but really it was the dialogue being placed like in like really cool areas, like in the surround sound.
No,
that was awesome.
He did use the surround sound to great effect.
Yeah, really.
Yeah.
And like the quick cut sounds and all that you would expect from a Edgar Wright film are in here.
Yeah.
And those are really cool.
Mm-hmm.
But the music choices themselves kind of fall apart after a while, and the score is not good.
Yeah.
So 6.
Okay. Next is S for shooting. This is the cinematographer's job. Is the cinematography eye-catching? What color palette do they use, and is there a reason they use it to enhance the movie?
Yeah.
Does the camera work enhance the scenes or make them unique? So this was a last-minute change for me.
Mm-hmm.
Last night, when I was grading this, I had given this a 4.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was thinking a lot about it last night and this morning, and I ended up changing it to a 9.
Oh my goodness. Wow. That's a big jump.
Well, here's the thing. At first, I really hated it. Because the 60s looked amazing. Like I said, about 20, 30 minutes in, when she has that first dream,
mm-hmm.
I was sold. And I was like, this is great. This is where it all comes into its own.
Mm-hmm.
And then as soon as that was over, it all felt boring and uninspired again.
Yeah.
And then I realized that wasn't by accident.
Yeah.
That was a very purposeful choice.
Yeah.
Because he wanted the 60s to seem really glamorous and to show this like this lifestyle that she had always been dreaming of and wanted.
Yeah.
And then showing her real life as boring and uninspired.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, that wasn't, you know, just bad filmmaking. That was actually what he wanted it to portray. And so like kind of regardless of how it made me feel in the moment, like watching it, I was like, that was actually really clever because it had exactly the effect that it was intended to.
Yeah.
And so I was like, okay, so maybe I was grading it too harshly because, my immediate thought was, oh, that was bad. And then I was like, no, that was like on purpose. That was like really good because it was bad. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up changing it pretty significantly.
Yeah. I also gave this one 6.
Okay.
Because like you were saying, the 60s stuff was super cool, especially at first.
Yeah.
With how dynamic the camera movements and all that were.
Yeah.
But after a while, it felt like you were saying, we didn't get like a lot of inspired shots or like cool, you know, movements or like really cool colors after a bit, like because, you know, it's meant to be that way. And it turned more into like a generic horror film feeling and look.
Yeah.
And I did not like that very much. Mm-hmm. So while I understand the intention behind it and what they're going for, it didn't do a whole lot for me. And I feel like I've made my point clear, like my preferred method of cinematography.
Yeah.
And how it's done. I like the docu-verite kind of feel mm-hmm. a lot. And this is not that. Edgar Wright has a very controlled cinematography style, and more often than not I love the way he does it.
Yeah.
But in this, it being toned down a lot more than his normal films,
mm-hmm.
Really did kind of take away from it more than I would generally feel towards his movies.
Yeah.
But again, like the 60s stuff was super cool, especially at the beginning with the camera sweeping around and the mm-hmm. cool dancing and all that, and how like dynamic it all felt. That was awesome.
Yeah.
And there were like little sprinkles here and there once it got out of that, that would like come up throughout. Like there was one shot where it was like a god's eye view of like the rain falling onto her. I thought that was pretty cool looking.
Mm-hmm.
But whenever you were in the actual like normal present day world,
mm-hmm.
it was kind of boring.
Yeah.
And that did kind of didn't bring me into the film very much.
Mm-hmm.
And that took away quite a bit.
Yeah.
From what I was hoping for.
Mm-hmm. All right. Next up is D for directing. Perhaps one of the most important elements, the director makes sure the movie comes together. Is the film effective at conveying a tone, message, or visual that the director intended? And can you identify them by their good or bad habits when filmmaking? I gave this a 6. Mm. I think if it were a different director, again, it might be a little bit higher.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a slightly above average horror movie, but it was not a slightly above average
Edgar Wright movie. No, not at all.
It was...
That's such a high bar to clear, too.
Yeah. And that's where it gets like really frustrating. It's just it wasn't a good Edgar Wright movie, which is what I keep coming back to. It's not even that it's a bad movie; it's a bad Edgar Wright movie.
Yeah,
which is what makes it tough. And it's not even like really clearly identifiable.
Mm-hmm.
It has some of his like trademarks, some of the way he utilizes music and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But if I didn't know it was Edgar Wright, I would not have been able to identify it the way I'm normally able to with the way that he makes his films. And I think that was partly on purpose.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was trying for that.
Mm-hmm.
But him achieving it did not make me like it.
Yeah. I gave this a 7. This is partially due to my bias already with like loving Edgar Wright's work.
Yeah.
But I think that he got his point across. He got what he was trying to say across, and I think he did it in more of like an interesting way than most other people would do it.
Yeah.
I think that his ideas and all that were clear, and he still had like his style sprinkled throughout.
Mm-hmm.
And while it did definitely feel more generic than his films usually would, it's still clearly like Edgar Wright-esque in a way, I guess. Yeah. Like I wouldn't say like an Edgar Wright film, even though it is, because like it doesn't feel as high quality as like any of his other films.
Yeah.
Literally any of his other films.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still like, you know, in that vein.
Yeah.
And I think that like there are some really cool ideas and cool methods used in this that definitely most other people would not even think about using.
Mm-hmm.
But again, like that's only because like this is Edgar Wright. This is like a visionary director.
Yeah.
Who is known for like this kind of stuff, so it's not like super surprising to see. So maybe, honestly, hearing you talk about it made me feel like a little generous giving it a 7. but yeah, like I'll stand by that. Why not? Okay.
E is for editing. Does the movie have a visual rhythm? Does it flow well, keep the viewer engaged, and scrub bad performances? And which angles do they use when cutting between cameras? I gave this a 9. Mm-hmm. I thought, regardless of how I felt about like the script and the predictability and stuff, this movie went off like a shotgun blast and just like did not let up. It was within, you know, what, maybe 10 minutes, you were seeing like kind of what you were in for, and it just kept on going. The chaos and like just kind of the overwhelming nature of it was so, like, I feel like it was powerfully told, and it just kept on going throughout the whole movie. There wasn't a moment where I was like, okay, it's stopping here and feels like boring to me. It felt like the movie was just kind of like flying through the whole time.
Yeah, so I had to check my math real quick to make sure my overall rating was right. The editing, I thought the editing was definitely like good. It was definitely good. The moments where Anya Taylor-Joy is like, you know, clearly being pimped out, it's super clear. She's like in the club, and you get those like cool, I guess this also kind of goes in the cinematography thing, where you get like the cool optical thing like around the head, where she's got like the little circles with the image again playing, like going around.
Yeah,
I thought that was cool. And and seeing like it cutting between everyone, like, oh, what's your name? She's giving them a different name each time and all that. Oh, that was that like, scene, interesting and fun.
Yeah, those cuts did feel like Edgar Wright to me, too.
Yeah.
And then there was also that scene where she's walking through the long hallway, and every time she looks in a different door to try to like find somewhere to escape to, it's like some other like sketchy thing going on.
And
like,
while that was like well edited, I thought it was super goofy, and really? I kind of chuckled a little bit looking at it. Yeah, because it was like, oh my god, this feels like a high school drama student film right here.
Right. But no, I thought it was really, the editing was pretty great.
Yeah, I thought the editing was really good too, and it had those like quick cut moments again with that we would get occasionally. Mm-hmm. But overall, yeah, super dynamic and fun, but just like not. When I think back at like Baby Driver, which had some of the best editing I've ever seen in my entire life, then it does kind of like take away from Last Night in Soho a little more. But it's still, again, like it's really good editing.
Yeah. What was your number?
7.
7 for editing. And finally, reflection. This is the most subjective of our categories. Simply a gauge of how much we enjoyed the film because of or despite the rankings we gave in other categories. I gave the Last Night in Soho a 5. Mm-hmm. It was just such a hodgepodge of like good and bad that I couldn't really enjoy it as much as I wanted to, even when there were like solitary distinct moments that I did really like.
Yeah,
it did not add up to a movie that I really enjoyed.
Yeah,
and I really wanted it. I mean, you know how I feel about Edgar Wright, and I really wanted to love this movie. I was so excited for this movie, and this like beautiful and surreal like 1960s look was not enough to save the movie.
No.
And I understand like kind of where he's coming from too, because I don't know how familiar you are with like the giallo horror
not
stylings.
Not at all. Well, like I've seen like the
like Suspiria and stuff, like that.
Yeah, I've seen certain stuff like that, but like not like a ton of it.
Yeah, and so I think he did capture that, and there are a lot of references to that, especially like the scene where she sees Matt Smith like stabbing Sandy, like that vision that she has.
Yeah,
And you see like her reflection, like screaming this like horrified expression in the knife.
Yeah.
If I remember right, is not even just like evocative. It's like directly taken. That was like actually taken from, I'm blanking on it, but it's one of Dario Argento's movies.
Is it like one part of the trilogy with Suspiria?
I think so. I'm blanking on the name of it, but I think like there were moments like that that were so clearly inspired by his love of like the giallo films and stuff, and also just like older like unique movies. Like, have you seen, or you probably haven't, Eyes Without a Face?
I have not. No.
There are some other movies too that aren't necessarily like the giallo horror, but just kind of
classical horror.
Yeah, classic horror that he really loves, and you can see those inspirations there.
Uh-huh.
And so I wanted to be more forgiving of the movie because he was going so clearly for a distinct style and genre that I'm familiar with, and I could see the inspirations there, but it wasn't what I wanted from an Edgar Wright movie.
Yeah. I also gave this a 5. Thinking back at the film itself, there was not really a moment where I was like super into it. There was a moment where I was like kind of leaning towards that, but it never fully drew me in. And I just constantly kept thinking like, I want more. Like, I want so much more, but it never gave me more. It always felt like mediocre at best most of the time. There's not a whole lot more I can say outside of what you just said. Like, you basically covered all the bases there.
Mm-hmm.
He clearly cared about what he was making.
Yeah.
But it felt like because he was trying to like cross some sort of like genre boundary that he's never really done before.
Yeah.
In like this kind of way, it didn't, maybe because like he didn't have like the right amount of time to like, you know, sort of figure things out as like much as he probably would like, but it didn't work out really at all. And it was severely disappointing.
Yeah. I realized while you were talking, I should probably clarify for anyone who's watching or listening that's not familiar, the term giallo is an Italian term for the color yellow.
Yeah.
It's G-I-A-L-L-O. And it's a term that was popularized for like 70s Italian horror movies.
Yeah.
In reference to their like surreal and
deep color saturation and all that.
Yeah, very deep color saturation, very surreal like horror stylings that were very popular at the time in Italian filmmaking. So if you aren't familiar, that's what I was referencing when I was talking about Dario Argento as a very well regarded auteur, like horror filmmaker, Italian horror filmmaker from like the 70s and 80s.
Yeah.
And I think he was very integral in kind of popularizing that term and that style of filmmaking.
But it wasn't just him, like Mario Bava.
Yeah, like there were others, but I think Argento is probably like one of the most prolific. Yeah.
Yeah.
He's kind of like
in America at least.
Yeah. And so if you weren't familiar, that's just kind of an explanation of like what we were referencing when we were talking about like that kind of style that Edgar Wright was going for with this movie. But with all that said, my final Wattmaster score for Last Night in Soho ended up being a 73.
Mine ended up being a 59.
Okay.
And at first it came out to a 71, and that's when I was like, I do not feel 71 about this. And so I had to bring it down a little bit.
Yeah.
And I feel very comfortable with a 59 because like, it's above average, I guess, in a way from most movies.
Yeah.
But it's not what I want in a movie, especially in an Edgar Wright movie.
Yeah.
So I'm severely disappointed in this. I'm a little mad at him, honestly. Okay, I wouldn't mind having a couple words with him.
Yeah. No, it was considering how excited we were to take in this movie, it was a lot to digest.
Yeah.
Not definitely. In a good way.
It's kind of weird. I hate thinking about how I enjoyed the 2021 Candyman more than I enjoyed Edgar Wright's newest film.
Yeah.
That's really disappointing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was like a... You know what? I've almost, real quick, I've almost enjoyed that stupid Birds of Paradise movie more than, or like on par with this, ooh, which I think I gave that like a 53.
Yeah.
And I gave this one a 59. But like, it's like they're so close.
I think I liked this better than Birds of Paradise.
I'm uncomfortable with it. I'm uncomfortable with how close they are.
Right.
Like it feels like it shouldn't be that way.
Yeah. But with that said, that was our take on Last Night in Soho, unfortunately. Hopefully, next week we'll have better things to say about our next movies, which we haven't really discussed yet. We were just talking at the beginning of the episode how we don't really have like a big upcoming movie for the next little bit. So we'll need to discuss what we're going to be reviewing and what we're going to be talking about next week. But until then, thank you guys for joining us. And we will see you in the next episode.
Bye. Bye.